Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to welcome Mark Van Stone. He's a professor of art history at Southwestern College in Chula Vista, California. He is co-author of the book Reading the Maya Glyphs, published by Thames and Hudson, and he is author of the forthcoming book, 2012, Science and Prophecy of the Ancient Maya. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks. I'm so glad to be here.
And Mark Van Stone will be in Santa Fe at the Palace of the Governors for a lecture and workshop this week. And the lecture is Friday, May 30th from 6:30 to 7:30 in the evening at the St. Francis Auditorium at the New Mexico Museum of Fine Arts in Santa Fe. And also he will be teaching a workshop, which we'll be talking about in a little while on Saturday, about how to draw Maya hieroglyphs. Now, as a Maya scholar, tell us, first of all, about some of the bizarre interpretations of the year 2012 that are floating around in popular culture right now.
Well, they range from questioning to bizarre, indeed. The source of this was a quotation in a book by Michael Coe in the 1960s, and he calculated that the Maya calendars... that there's one Maya calendar that is cycling through a very large cycle of 5,000 years to a date which they wrote as 13000, which is basically a five-digit number in base 20. And that date, which we'll reach in December of 2012, is precisely the same denotation as the date that they gave to the beginning of time, the creation of the world 5,000 some years ago. And Mike, while writing a book called The Maya, which is a very successful sort of textbook introduction to the culture, realized that he'd be alive in 2012 when the calendar reached this number again, sort of like reaching midnight after, you know, a whole day's time. And he hypothesized that perhaps the Maya considered this to be a kind of cycle like the Hindu kalpas, and that that there were cycles of the world of destruction and creation, and that maybe that they had some concept that this cycle would be bringing time to an end or the world to an end or something like that. And he's the first person, I believe, to have done this calculation. And other people read this book. It's a very popular textbook on the Maya, and some people have picked up on this as essentially being a Y2K event. Many people have postulated that it represents a renewal of the world, that, you know, that once you take this, what should I say, end time, this recreation as a metaphor. And indeed, the Maya and the Aztecs both describe the creation of the world in terms of cycles of creation, destruction, and recreation. Some people who are sky watchers of other persuasions, shall we say, the people who follow Western horoscopy in the zodiac, and people who have studied Chinese and Hindu, deep history and astrology, have seen some coincidences with the Maya beginning and end date with coinciding with, you know, the age of Aquarius and other sort of changes heralded by the Western zodiac and, like I said, the Chinese and the Hindu, perhaps Tibetan as well. In any case, there is also some other interesting correlations. I don't want to say coincidences. That makes it seem too trivial. The day that the Maya calendar reaches its end point, reaches its 13000, happens to be a solstice, at least by one of the correlations between the Maya calendar and the European one. Winter solstice, and that seems too interesting to be a coincidence. And also, on that day, the Earth, the Sun, and the center of the galaxy will be lined up, and that seems to be a celestially significant event. And that particular event is one that happens only rarely, in some sense. For the Sun to be rising, essentially, with the center of the galaxy directly behind it from the viewpoint of the Earth, on the winter solstice, it happens due to the precession of the equinox. This happens once every 26,000 years. That seems to be an important, significant event. There's also a solar maximum, and there's also, in 2012, in June, there will be a transit of Venus, an event that happens twice every 120 years, a fairly rare celestial event. There are a few other sort of things which seem to have a significance to the New Age community, which correlate with this particular date. In any case, many people have fixed upon it as perhaps the Maya knew something that we don't, and that they were telling us that something important is going to happen on that date, and that there seem to be other clues that things are coming together, that a big change is going to happen. And I would say that some of the people predicting change are predicting the end of the human race, or the end of the human race in bodily form, and what I consider to be extreme predictions about the change of consciousness of the world, you know, becoming all the human race being united into a single mind-body. Predictions like that have very little to do with anything the Maya ever said. In any case, there's a very, very large range of people who are talking about 2012 as being a time of change and interpreting it as a time of change, and the kind of change that they predict is ranges all over the map. A few respectable, in my eyes, scholars try to set themselves apart from the people that they call bandwagon jumpers, people who are, you know, who've been spending many years researching the Maya calendar and what the Maya knew and how they developed their calendar and what they might have known about it. And then there are people who just project. I would say that the greatest criticism I might level on some of the people that are more extreme in their prophecies about what the Maya expected or believed or were telling us is that they simply project their own desires and fantasies on this, just as people did in the year 2000.
You talked a moment ago about how the Maya creation myth, or one of the Maya creation myths, goes back about 5,000 years, which is kind of the same as the Christian creation myth. And I think it's a good time to talk about the difference between myth, reality, and history and imagination.
Well, I remember a quotation from Joseph Campbell. He said that myth, someone told him that a myth is a kind of a lie. And he said, no, a myth is a truth that is somehow greater than real truth, in the sense that myth is a story, an archetype that is perhaps not true in its specific, in its very specifics, in its historical specifics, such as the name of the person, the location of the place, or the date that it happened, but that the outline of the story, you know, the hero myth, if you will, or the king trying to avoid his fate myth, these stories are perennial and they're ubiquitous. A myth is a story that you change the names, you change the dates, but it's the same story. It's a story that's true everywhere. It's a story that's true that tells something about humanity. And then there's the Western concept of history, which tries in a very materialistic way to connect the dots about things that happened in reality, in a real time, in a measurable scientific way, such as the signing of the Declaration of Independence. You know, this is, in some sense, the signing of the Declaration of Independence is an American mythic event. It has these powerful connotations of the creation of our country and so forth, but it was also a historical event. It was an event that, you know, a bunch of guys did get together in a sweaty room in Philadelphia in July of 1776, and they did sign a document. Didn't all happen, you know, in one moment or one day, but the event did happen, and that is history. And historians are kind of scientists who are trying their best to establish externally verifiable criteria for specifics of an event. And the farther back you go in history, of course, the less successful you're going to be at verifying any facts. The original materials, the original people are gone, and the original things they wrote down are subjective, and the things that people wrote about them are even more subjective and subject to distortions. And the Maya concept of history, and this is going to be one of the important points of my talk, the Maya concept of history is very, very different from the Western concept of history. It's much more interlaced with mythic truths and propaganda in the sense that what we find written on the Maya monuments, the stone monuments, is pretty much what we find written on our stone monuments, which is to say statements to the effect that the leaders are good people and that they're doing their job and that God has chosen them to lead their people to the light and to do good things for their people. And, you know, a good deal of history is names and dates and essentially a short statement to the effect that so-and-so is doing his job. You know, General Sherman led his troops. Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves. I mean, statements like this are the kind of historical events that are recorded on monuments. And the Maya monuments that we have, that is to say the stone monuments they put up, say pretty much the same thing. And the interesting difference between what the Maya choose to put on their monuments and what we choose to carve on the inside of the Lincoln Memorial, for instance, or on the statue of General Sherman in whatever city he's in, is that the Maya kings record again and again that the job they're doing is a spiritual one, that they are connecting with the heavens, connecting with the underworld, doing their job, protecting their people by interceding with the gods. I mean, literally they're saying that so-and-so did this ceremony and that he incensed this building and that he let blood in honor of such and such a god and that he had a hallucination and saw this god. This is the kind of thing which they saw fit to carve on their monuments. And we don't have any monuments to say Abraham Lincoln, you know, had a hallucination. We don't have anything that says that, the most important thing that George Washington did was to dedicate his temple. This is the kind of thing that a deeply religious society in which religion is integral to their culture records.
And it's interesting that in one place in your work I was reading that the society was so religious that they don't have a word for religion.
Gosh, I don't remember writing that. But that is.
It was in the reading the Maya glyphs. There was just a statement that they don't have a word there's no word religion.
Indeed, just as in Bali, people in Bali say they don't have a word for art.
Right, exactly.
Is an artist. Yeah, I think that one of the things that Linda Shealy, the great decipherer and my mentor, said about her epiphany when she first discovered the Maya was that she said, these are people to whom art is central. And she meant that their art and their religion and their daily life were all united in a very, very integrated way, which we don't have in our Western culture. As an artist, as an art historian, and as a person fascinated with writing, with calligraphy and writing as an art, I agree that the Maya have this highly integrated cultural quality which is missing from Western culture. I'm sure that I'm not the only person who's bemoaned the fact that secularization, which I say divorces something that is very fundamental to our motivations, our sense of reason to live, divorces that from our daily life.
So how do we know about their daily lives, and what do we know?
Excellent question. We know a lot from archaeology, which, does things like digs up 150 house mounds in Tikal and looks through their garbage, and basically talks with the modern Maya, whose lifestyle in some ways bears some striking similarities to the way they've always lived. The Maya themselves tell us a lot about, in addition to they're saying the king is doing his job, they mention things like marriages and alliances and things like that. There are many different kinds of archaeologists, but I think of there being two sort of main groups. One is the people that are looking for treasure, looking for beautiful things, looking for beautiful buildings and beautiful sculptures and works of art, and I tend to fall into that category. And the people who are, on the other hand, trying to find out about the life of the ordinary person and who do very unglamorous surveys of, pollen counts and bone analysis and, like I said, trash analysis, trying to find out exactly as much as possible how many people lived in a house and what they cooked and whether they had, diseased teeth. And we can deduce a great deal from sort of statistical analyses like this. And the third group, the ethnologists, the ethnographers, informed by what we find in Maya archaeological digs, they interview the modern Maya. And like I said, that especially in the more remote areas, the modern Maya have many, many cultural features that are in that haven't changed that much with the conquest of the Spaniards and the
Including the integration of spiritual and so-called secular, you know, regular mundane daily life, has some of that continued as well?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's an excellent question. And I would say that despite the fact that modern Maya and in fact all over Mesoamerica, the modern Mesoamerican indigenous culture is deeply battered and bruised by its contact and domination by European culture. There are, you know, I think I have many students from Mexico and Guatemala, and I always ask them if they have any relatives that are poor and live in the country, and they, you know, the few people who put up their hands, and I ask them about how religious they are, and they you know, 9 out of 10 say they're the most devout and religious people they know, that the simple people living in the, you know, in the forests and in the farms and in the hinterlands tend to be the most conservative and the most devout people. And, you know, devotion and simplicity are profound ways of conservative forces, if you will, profoundly conservative forces. And there are, for instance, I like to point out that when a Maya man lays out his cornfield, for one thing, he goes to the corners of the cornfield and he pricks his earlobe and he sprinkles blood on the corners of the ear of this cornfield. This is not done by every man that does it, but many people still do it, and they've been doing it since pre-Columbian times. They shed blood to bless the land and to ask the gods favor. And when they lay out the cornfield, they lay it out in a golden rectangle or a root 2 rectangle or some other geometrical form that is easily constructed with, you know, knotted ropes and, you know, it's essentially the compass and ruler construction that Euclid used. And they do so because these proportions have been sacred for a long time. It's the same shape as a Maya house and the same shape as an ancient Maya temple. And sacred geometry has long been a part of even the humblest Maya life. And that's something that, you know, the Spanish didn't bother to exterminate. They, you know, there are many things that many practices and many echoes of pre-Columbian daily life that didn't offend the conquistadors and the friars, and they allowed them to continue, and they became integrated into the daily life there. And so,
is it possible that the Spanish didn't even notice that those things were part of their religion?
Certainly, of course. Every culture has its own idea of what's religion and what's not religion. And when the friars were imposing, you know, Christianity onto Maya life ways and so forth, they only cared about what they noticed and what they cared about. And, you know, whether the shall we say, the way that you put water on a field has a religious meaning or not, you're right, they never noticed. But I wanted to say that the way that the farmer lays out his field and sheds blood echoes one of the creation myths. When a farmer is planting his field, or when a family is building their house, they are echoing one of the creation stories. They are recreating the world when they build their house or when they plant their cornfield. And when a woman gets up early in the morning, before the sun rises, and in the dark of her house, lights a candle and grinds corn. Human beings in the myth of the Popol Vuh were created from corn. And when a woman is there grinding corn in the dark, she is doing what the gods did when they created men. And so every morning, a Maya peasant woman is in some sense reenacting creation.
And there's an awareness. Really cool. There's an awareness of that on some level.
Yes, there is.
Very interesting. And it's something that The examples you gave have so much to do with the production of food, and for us living in secular capitalist society, our lives are about making enough money so that we can go to a store and buy things that are in bags. So
right.
We're so far removed from that process, even if we wanted to be closer to it.
Good point.
We're talking to Mark Van Stone. So one of the other interesting contrasts that you make is in the modern representation of Maya society. You have, on the one hand, the bloody human sacrifice scenario that you've seen Mel Gibson movies and so on, and then these esoteric wisdom practices of the Maya priests, which in a way, kind of put them on a pedestal.
Yes.
Are both of these things true on some level? How do you sort out the deeper truth of these modern representations?
Well, you know, in Mel Gibson's case, I would say that the most egregious thing that he did is projected his own fantasies on the Maya. I mean, really, they're both true because people are complex, and that in every culture there are brilliant people, and that there are deep thinkers, and that there are philosophers, and in every culture there are, you know, bloody, vicious killers. And sometimes, in many cultures, sadistic practices find their way into religious practice. And the Maya, like most Mesoamericans, believed that any sacrifice was an investment, and that blood sacrifice in particular was a gift you gave to the gods in exchange for something that they gave back to you in, you know, multiplying. When you gave them treasure, when you buried jade, or when you burned a mask and threw it into a well, or when you burned incense, which costs a lot of money to collect and create, or when you let your own blood, you're giving the gods something valuable, and you're doing that with the express purpose of paying them off so that they'll give you something more valuable back. And every sacrifice in every culture is made for the greater good. And the blood sacrifice that we see in the Mel Gibson film, it's possible that in the later, especially in the post-classic, that the Maya sacrificed people wholesale, like we saw with the bodies falling down the steps one by one. We know that the Aztecs did that. But the Aztecs' belief in, what should I say, what the gods desired, and the Aztecs' sort of weekly, monthly, yearly ritual, and what sort of sacrifices were demanded by the gods, were extremely bloody and extremely specific. And they believed that the gods had let their own blood in order to make the sun begin to move, and that if they did not get blood sacrifice every day, that the sun wouldn't rise. And so the Aztecs were particularly violent in the sense of having blood sacrifices where they killed people and took out their hearts and cut their heads off and stuff. There's some evidence that, you know, it was a big surprise to everyone in 1986 when Linda Shealy and Mary Miller announced that the Maya were actually as violent as any other culture. Up until that time, there was this romantic notion that the Maya never made war on each other, and that they never had, you know, serious sacrifice. The Maya were an idealized, what shall I say, a spiritual culture that watched the stars and did arithmetic and you know, quietly lived their brilliant lives there in the jungle. And it's only been the past 20 years that people have begun to realize that the Maya were just as sanguine as everyone else. The one distinction that I think is very interesting about the Maya concept of blood sacrifice and everyone else's is that the Maya believed that the gods wanted the blood of nobles and of rulers, of kings, and that to sacrifice just anyone that you go out and capture in the jungle, and that was not what the gods were interested in. They didn't want the blood of ordinary people. That would get back, shall we say, a sort of ordinary return from the gods. If you wanted a real good return, you gave them the blood of noblemen, the blood of kings. And so, you know, either you went out and collected the nobility of the neighboring city and sacrificed them, or you learned to give blood without killing people. And so the kings and queens sacrificed their own blood repeatedly. They discovered, you know, what parts of your body you can stab without making scars. And they committed self-sacrifice, not necessarily daily, but every time an important ritual happened, the king or queen had to let blood. And there's some very graphic images of that, particularly at Yash Chilan in more private works of art. The doorways of buildings, the lintels, shall we say, of Yash Chilan, have some very interesting images of a king and queen celebrating an important ceremony where they let blood. The most graphic image is a very famous image of a queen running a rope through her tongue with thorns on it. And, of course, the tongue bleeds like crazy when you cut it, and it heals without a scar. And that's a much more efficient way to let blood than, shall we say, by cutting your arm or even your earlobe. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, the Aztecs, despite their intense, what shall I say, their not only sanguinary but bellicose attitudes, their belief in struggle as the way that you sustain the universe, their belief that they had to make constant war on their neighbors as being something that the gods decreed. They had this very, very aggressive, bellicose, bloody culture. At the same time, their philosophers were highly, highly refined, and you know, they wrote beautiful poetry, and they had the most amazing gardens that knocked the socks off the Spaniards when they first saw them. That they had zoos and gardens and poetry and this very, very highly refined artistic sense. It's a lot like the culture of Tamerlane, this very, very vicious, aggressive killer who conquered Central Asia and then set up, you know, universities. And Genghis Khan, who conquered China, or his children or grandchildren conquered China, and his grandson, Kublai Khan, was, you know, if Marco Polo is to be believed, Kublai Khan was one of the most, besides being this powerful man whose conquest was based on this really bloody past, was a supporter of the arts and everything in the most refined way. And this often happens. As soon as the butchers establish their kingdom, they set up they bring in the scholars. And so I'd say, in some sense, even in the Aztec culture, there was great refinement and great intellectual and spiritual accomplishments and beautiful poetry, and at the same time as there was this violent, bloody, sanguinary aesthetic of conquest. And the Maya were, I'm not going to say no different. The Maya were different because their use of blood and their use of violence as a way of worshiping was much more, I think it's just much more fair for the king to have to stab his own self than to stab his neighbors, you know? But there seems to be some evidence that although the monuments show a king standing on one or maybe two captives, or they have titles like, you know, he of five captives or he of 20 captives, meaning that this king accomplished, you know, 20 captures in his life of neighboring rulers who were sacrificed, perhaps the monuments are abbreviations. You know, perhaps they did have ceremonies in which they would sacrifice 5 or 10 or 20 or even 50 people. You know, we don't know. The monuments record sacrifices of rarely more than one person. And the paintings in Bonampak have, I think, 9 people sitting on the steps, obviously humiliated and tortured, and one of them with his head cut off. But nothing wholesale like the Aztecs. So, like every culture, it was a complex patchwork of different kinds of persuasions, and that there was blood on the one hand and books on the other.
We're talking to Mark Van Stone, professor of art history and co-author of the book Reading the Maya Glyphs. Just so we can ground ourselves, when did the Maya civilization that we're talking about and that produced the Maya calendar and so on, when did it flourish? What centuries are we talking about here?
The usual dates given for the Classic period, and the Classic period was named by archaeologists who are enamored of the Maya, is 250 A.D. to 900 A.D. The earliest dated monuments we have appeared around 300 A.D., and the last dated monuments were carved around 900 to 950. And Chichen Itza flourished from about, say, 850 to about 1,000. However, recent archaeology has discovered that underneath these classic cities, there lies a surprisingly sophisticated and flourishing pre-classic, late pre-classic, they call it, Maya civilization. The murals of San Bartolo, for instance, which date from 50 BC, are, you know, right in the center of what we call the late pre-classic or the late formative, are surprisingly sophisticated, and they establish that that the Maya, at least in San Bartolo, which is just a tiny little, you know, third-tier city, that the Maya of San Bartolo had in place their art styles, their production of paintings and books and sculpture, and the way of royal succession and the myths, the very sophisticated and complex myths of creation and the four corners of the universe and so forth, they were already well in place and in the late preclassic Maya, and no doubt in the late preclassic Zapotec and the people that succeeded the Olmec, who had collapsed around 300 BC. I would say that Maya culture starts in the late preclassic. You know, Maya culture as we know it, it has its antecedents in the late preclassic, which are only beginning to be understood. Say around 200, 300 BC, we start to see a culture we could distinctively call the Maya. In space, they were located in eastern Mesoamerica, that is to say, in the eastern parts of Chiapas and Tabasco, and all of Guatemala and Belize, and the entire Yucatan Peninsula, even today, is pretty much Maya-speaking. Mind you, they speak 22 different languages in that Maya field, but the culture that we call the classic Maya existed in that area, that is to say, you draw a line through the Isthmus of Tehuantepec from the skinniest part of Mexico to the east, and the sort of the borders of Honduras and El Salvador with Guatemala north. That's pretty much where the classic Maya lived, and they really started to build major buildings from about the time of Christ up until about 900. So they ruled for the first millennium.
Now, when we started talking about the Maya calendar, you referred to calendar as the plural, the Maya calendars.
Yes.
What is this thing that the sort of New Age mythologized Maya calendar, and where does it stand in the context of multiple calendars?
Excellent question. Boy. We have a way of telling the cycle of the year by calling what we call the days of the month. You know, today's the 30th of May, 2008. That's three different cycles. One is the number of days in a month, which can go up to 30 or 31. Another is these 12 moons, if you will, of the year, each of which has a name. And then there's the cycle that counts the number of years since the birth of our Redeemer, though it's, a little bit corrupted, that apparently he was born 6 B.C., and it's been secularized. We count 2008 years since supposedly the birth of Christ. And the Maya equivalent to that 2008 years is what we call the long count calendar. And that is the calendar that is cycling up to its big 000 year in 2012. And they also had a calendar of essentially for the agricultural cycle, the yearly round of things, just like our months of the year. They had a 365-day calendar, which we call the Hab, and they had a sacred calendar, which is kind of like the days of the week. You know, we have a cycle of 7 days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, that just goes around and around, has really no correlation or linking with the other calendars. It's just a way of keeping time for our work week. You know, we have Sundays off. They had a 260-day calendar, which was probably the most fundamental and important calendar that they used. Everything revolved around what we call the Tzolk'in. Tzolk'in means a count of days. And the count of the days, with its 260 named and numbered days, it doesn't, of course it gets out of sync with the solar calendar immediately, right? It's 100 days shorter than the solar calendar.
Right.
So they had the Tzolk'in, which was so important that children were named for the Tzolk'in day they were born on. It's sort of like being named, Sebastian, if you're born on St. Sebastian's Day.
Right.
It was a sacred calendar, and it was the most old calendar, the oldest of the several calendars they used. The Hab, which is the 365-day calendar, combined with the sacred calendar, the Tzolk'in, into what we call a calendar round. And those two, the date and the calendar round, the date and the Hab, together were the way that Maya specified time in history. That is to say that, when the king was crowned, they would say he was born on, say, four ahau eight yab or something like that. No, it can't be yab. Yab only goes to five.
It's okay because none of us understand it anyway.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. They would specify it with in those two calendars, the hob and the tzol came together, could specify a specific day in a person's life, because those two calendars together, the way that they cycle and interact, they don't repeat a specific day, and they repeat a specific day every 52 years, and so you generally see only one of any specific day in that calendar. And then the long count calendar, which was the one that was most often used, carved onto monuments, the long count, like our 2008, is, like I said, that's the one that's the more linear. That is to say, it doesn't cycle through like the 260-day calendar or 365-day calendar, which repeats every year. Supposedly, it repeats every 5,000 years. And there does exist one monument which makes a prophecy, and it says that on 13000, that this coming date, which was 1,000 years in the future when they carved it,
and which is December in 2012.
December 2012, and it's either the 21st or the 23rd, depending on which correlation you use with the European calendar. But most of the people that bring attention to this date are you know, convinced that the December the 21st correlation is the one that's that is more correct, simply because it makes it fall on the solstice. In any case, there is one monument. It was carved in the city of Tortuguero around 700 AD. It's called Tortuguero 6, and it's a very long text, and it talks about the royalty and their ceremonies and their marriages and their alliances and so forth. And at the very end, it says, you know, several hundred years from now, it will be. And it gives the Maya version, Maya equivalent 1300 of four ahau, three kankin is what they say, which is, again, the calendar round for this final date. It says the 13th peak will end, the 13th, the cycle will again return to 13000 is what they're saying. And then they tell us what's going to happen on that date. It's a very unusual monument because it's one of the very, very few Maya monuments that makes a specific prediction about the future.
And what does it say?
Unfortunately, the verb is destroyed. It says that Bolognokte, who is either one god or nine gods, will come down from, and then that glyph is destroyed, or maybe, pardon me, come down to, and then it does, the place he's coming down to is destroyed. It looks like the place that he's coming down to has the word black in it, the black something place. And what he's going to do when he gets there is also broken.
So it could be anything. It could be that there's going to be an earthquake somewhere.
Yeah, it could be. It could be that he's what they often predict. The interesting thing is that 99 out of 100 Maya monuments that talk about the future predict simply that a king will perform a ceremony, that they will burn incense, or that they will note that it is the first of the year. I mean, they'll literally say that, you know, 142 years from now, it will be January 1st.
Right.
And that's pretty much what they say about the future. And this monument's very intriguing in that it seems to make a prediction that is not trivial, unfortunately. What it actually said has been lost and unlikely to be recovered. But the god that is going to come down, Bolognokte, is a god that did appear on the last creation. He was one of the gods that put together the universe in 3014 BC, which was the last 13000. And he's a god of change and a god of conflict. And Bolognokte can be translated a number of ways. It means nine-foot tree or something like that. Foot meaning the foot of the tree, the base of the tree. It could be nine supporters. And te can mean other things besides tree. But some people translate his name as many are his strides. You know, he takes big steps. In any case, the name doesn't tell us a whole lot about the god, and he's really fairly minor god as far as the Maya religious books are concerned. He barely is mentioned. But be that as it may, he's a god that appeared in the previous creation and appears in the next creation. And epigraphers, decipherers are always bemoaning the fact that there's a kind of Murphy's Law that when you have a monument that says something interesting, the most interesting part of it is always broken. This is the case here.
So, Mark Van Stone, you're going to be in Santa Fe, and on Friday from 6:30 to 7:30, you will be speaking at the St. Francis Auditorium at the New Mexico Museum of Fine Arts. And the lecture is titled, It's Not the End of the World, What the Ancient Maya Really Said About 2012. So what they really said was there's a lot of words missing and we don't really know what they really said is what I'm hearing from you right now.
Unfortunately, yes. But if you believe that the Maya had some concept of cyclic time and that things repeated, and so I'll be looking into what they said about the last creation, too, to try and figure out whether they would have expected big change. And the interesting thing that I found as far as looking into their monumental texts is that they talk about the time beyond 2012 as if nothing will have changed. They make frequent references to events happening, you know, in the year 4700 AD and you know, even farther into the future. And the things that they say are going to happen on those days are mundane things. The same things that they say that they're doing today, which is, you know, celebrating this ceremony or incensing this temple or letting blood or just observing the passage of time by, you know, saying it's now the end of the century. The evidence suggests that they expected to live beyond 2012 and to live normal lives beyond 2012.
Tell us about the workshop that you're going to be teaching on Saturday.
The workshop I'm teaching on Saturday is essentially an appreciation of the aesthetic of Maya glyphs. I come to the study of Maya writing from a past as a calligrapher, and I have a deep love for the artistic qualities of Maya writing. It's a highly aesthetic, very beautiful writing system, and the workshop will include essentially instructions and tips on how to draw a hieroglyph in a useful way. There's a lot of different techniques. Artists have all different ways of representing things, but there are certain standards that epigraphers and decipherers expect from a drawing of an inscription, and I'll be touching on those, and I will be I'll be giving lots and lots of examples of things that students can learn to draw and learn to see. I'd say the biggest part of learning to write Maya is, of course, learning to see what's there. Learning to, like any writing system, there are some very, very specific conventions and highly restricted. Writing is extremely limited in its use of signs and its use of writing conventions. There are many, many, many things you can do when you're drawing a landscape, but there's only a certain few things you can do when you're writing a hieroglyph. The learning the conventions of writing hieroglyphs that the Maya themselves imposed on the system go a long way towards helping you to decipher a damaged and broken inscription. Because you can say, oh, this has got to be a verb. You know, a verb goes here, and so we look for the verb endings. And the dictionary of Maya verbs that are written on monuments is really rather limited. And so you can sometimes say, oh, this is a coming down verb, you know, or this is a crowning verb, you know, that sort of thing. It's essentially an introduction to Maya aesthetics through drawing.
Well, Mark Van Stone, I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for asking me.
And we look forward to seeing you very soon.
Thank you, Charlotte.
Mark Van Stone is a professor of art history at Southwestern College in Chula Vista, California. He is co-author of the book Reading the Maya Glyphs, published by Thames and Hudson, and author of the forthcoming book 2012, Science and Prophecy of the Ancient Maya. He will be in Santa Fe, speaking on Friday from 6:30 to 7:30 at the St. Francis Auditorium at the New Mexico Museum of Fine Arts. And that's a free lecture. and it's titled, It's Not the End of the World, What the Ancient Maya Really Said About 2012. And on Saturday, he will be teaching a workshop. For more information on all of this, you can call 476-5096. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.